Hello, I'm Christopher Cassan, and this is Ireland's Edge. On today's episode, University Challenge. What is the state of Ireland's higher education sector? For centuries, our universities have been at the heart of Irish intellectual life, not only as places of education, but also as centres of politics, culture, and debate. Ireland now has one of the most university-educated populations in the world, with well more than half of young people achieving a third-level degree. But political, financial, and digital pressures mean that the future of our universities is far from certain. So today, two of Ireland's leading university presidents offer us their assessment of the challenges and opportunities they face. Orla Feely is president of University College Dublin, the first woman to hold that post in the university's 170-year history. By training, she is an electrical engineer who originally studied at UCD and at University of California, Berkeley. John O'Halloran is president of University College Cork. He is an ornithologist by training and has previously worked at universities in the US and the UK. At Ireland's Edge in Dingle, they spoke with Professor John Nocton, Senior Research Fellow at Cambridge University and well-known technology columnist with the Observer newspaper.
I thought we might start by having two victims of torture. One of them is John O'Halloran, whom I've known for many years and admired a lot. And my only complaint about him is with the governing body of UCC, which took so long to make him president. So John's going to join us. He's going to sit there. John?
Thanks. Thanks, sir.
And then we have Orla Feely, who's now the president since May of University College Dublin. Both of these people are terrific, absolutely terrific advocates for the universities. And if you doubt that, you should have a look at the video of Orla's inaugural address, which was absolutely, really wonderful. Like Orla, I'm a Bachelor of Engineering from UCC, so I'm an engineer. She's a more distinguished engineer than I am. She's did a PhD at Berkeley, and she came back to UCD and worked her way through and climbed the greasy pole to where she now sits. I describe myself as a recovering utopian. I've been a newspaper columnist for a long time. I write for The Observer, which is owned by The Guardian, which means people think I write for The Guardian. But that doesn't matter because The Guardian has a really big reach. There was a time when the Observer had an editor-in-chief, not normally a title that newspapers have in England, and he was Conor Cruise O'Brien. Does that ring a bell?
Yes. Yep.
Okay. He was a fantastically interesting man, very complicated, very gifted, with an amazing experience. He'd been the United Nations High Representative in Katanga during the Civil War. He'd been Vice Chancellor of the University of Ghana. He had been the Schweitzer Professor of Humanities at New York University, and he came back and ran for the Doyle and became a government minister here. He was also a formidable drinker. And you took your life in your hands when you went out with him, and one night, on Friday night, after my colleague had gone to bed, I found myself in a pub with Conor. And at one point, he turned to me and he said, "Is it true that you're an academic and a journalist?" And I said, well, I'm afraid it is, Conor. And he said, "You're just like me. You have a foot in both graves." And I sit here tonight, today, as somebody in those both graves, the foot of both graves, and I propose to have a discussion with our two distinguished colleagues here. The theme of this year's Ireland Edge is trust. And more or less since their inception, universities have been organisations or institutions that were believed to be trustworthy in important respects. And I think the question that comes to my mind now is, as our democracies erode, and they are eroding, will this perception that universities are trustworthy also erode in a polarized society with a fractured public sphere, great polarization and massive inequalities? So that's what we're here to talk about. And we're going to focus on three things. One of them is freedom of thought and expression. How well are universities now defending that freedom in a polarized world. Secondly, we're going to talk about the increasing, but maybe unwitting, political role that universities are now playing in many democracies, especially in the UK and the US. And thirdly, the way that the humanities in universities seem to be steadily eviscerated in favor of STEM subjects. So we've got three things to cover, and we'll go as quickly as we can. But I want to kick up with the first ones. I want to ask both of you, how well are universities defending intellectual freedom now? John?
Yeah, I'm between two engineers, so I'm not sure how I'm feeling. I'm an ecologist, so one on the left of me, one on the right of me, I'm not quite sure. How are universities doing? I would say declining in our people's minds is the importance of trust. And I suppose it begs the question, what do we mean when we talk about trust? What are we trying to do here? And universities typically are places where we generate new knowledge. And fundamentally, for me, about seeking truth. I mean, that's fundamentally what I think university is about. So we'll come back to some of these points in a moment. But my sense is that we're in a place where it's not clear as to the extent to which we're trusted. And why am I hesitating? Because this might shock people, but I can only speak for my own university, I might say something different, but if I think of University College Cork, and I particularly look at the funding system, we're very like RTE. I say, John, where are you going with this one? And I'm not talking about governance matters here now, I'm talking about funding. Because RTE for decades have been talking about public sector funding, and we're talking about public sector funding for higher education. And our ministers, and everybody agrees, actually. It's not that people disagree. And why am I raising this? Not because I want to raise the ante on funding, which I always do. But if your funding is restricted, you have to behave in a different way. You have to look for commercial activity. University College Cork budget is about 500 million every year. We get about 90 million from the state. We've got to find the rest. So if you've got to find the rest, there may need to be trade-offs. People will put pressure on you. If we're giving you money for X, are you going to give me Y? So the extent to which you can act independently, and what we refer to as independent thinking, I think brings a huge challenge to all of us. So I think the fundamental piece for me is, how do we have the transparency of that money so that people can believe what's been said in the universities, and ultimately about expertise. And we all saw what happened over the last number of years about people saying, but they're experts everywhere. Everybody's an expert. They're not, actually. They're not. And, you know, and we need knowledge. And I've my knowledge, you've your knowledge, everybody here has their own knowledge. Yes, we have experiences, and that can contribute to knowledge. But we have to recognize that some of us, including myself, know something about some things and less about others. And I think that acknowledgement is really, really important. And I think our universities are trying to create a space for those kinds of conversations to happen. And they're not easy conversations.
But part of the problem is that it's a bit like the problem that journalists always have in dealing with real experts, which is that in many cases on controversial issues, you ask somebody who has studied it a lot, what's the answer to this?
Yeah.
And the academic will normally say, well, it depends.
Yeah.
And that's no good for a headline.
Yeah, but at the same time, if you take my experience, the best person to teach a first-year class, which are probably the hardest classes to teach, are actually the best experts.
Right.
Because why? Because they have broken the complexity down into simple messages, but not deviating from the complexity and the facts.
Yeah.
And I think that's really important. This is not about simplification. It's about simplification. It's not about dumbing down, actually. It's about sticking with the facts. So I think we all have to challenge each other. And we had a conversation earlier with our colleague from the Department of Education, and we challenged each other. And I think the key message I will always say is, when somebody says something, whether it's a journalist or anybody else, what are the facts of the matter first? Can we agree on those? And we might disagree on them too, and that's fine. But at least start on the basis of facts rather than fiction. And we saw what happened in the UK during the COVID period. Everybody said everybody had an opinion. And that's just not good enough.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Orla.
In terms of how we are doing in protecting freedom of expression in universities, I think we are seeing it, and I'm talking globally now, not particularly within Ireland, I think we are seeing freedom of expression in universities under threat from without and within to an extent that we have not done for some time. So we see in many countries around the world, we see universities being closed down or moved. We see politicians interfering in curricula. We see governments making fairly clumsy intervention around culture wars or whatever. So we see from outside the system, we see really important stakeholders seeking to exert influence on freedom of expression within universities to an alarming extent. From within, we are starting to see increasingly an intolerance to alternative views. Yeah. Universities have to be places where all views are heard, are listened to. We are nothing if we do not teach our students to listen to points of view with which they disagree, even when they disagree with them very, very vehemently. But they have to learn to listen to them, to understand them, to be able to refute and rebut them and not just, you know, put up their hands and refuse to engage. I think that is so fundamental to democracy. Now, I do think, and again, whether I'm the recovering or not utopian in this, I don't know, you can tell me. I do think we're not as far down that road in Ireland as in other countries that we're all aware of. We have really, really strong legislative underpinning of academic freedom in our Universities Act. This is, and if you look at, say, the university barometers around Europe, Ireland scores really, really high for academic freedom. We score very low for autonomy and funding, but that's to John's point. So I do think that we are better placed in Ireland now than in other jurisdictions, but who's to say that that will continue to be the case? It's something we have to be vigilant about.
In the UK, I mean, people are complacent, or were complacent about it, but yeah. I work in Cambridge, and I remember a couple of years ago, some student body invited somebody called Jordan Peterson, well-known controversial figure, to give a talk, and there was such a set of demonstrations and resistance to it, and the rest of that, the thing was disgracefully cancelled. It was later restored, but the shock for the system was that suddenly there were people who didn't want to hear this person, even though he's a perfectly legitimate thinker. You might not agree with him, but and so I think that problem is more pathological in the US now.
Very much
but
some
of it is seeping our way as well.
Yeah. When you see politicians intervene to see what can and cannot be on the curriculum, what books can and cannot be on shelves in our universities, this goes to the very core of who we are as universities.
And just in relation to...
I just picked that one up, John. So Orlin and I have had the privilege of both, and different times been in Harvard for what Michael Murphy, our previous president, referred to as the false course for presidents, for those who understand those. I was there the year before last, and there were 54 presidents, of which 50 were from the United States. And every single worried about democracy. Every single worried about, as Orla said, what was in the curriculum. And when you get this, a group of people telling that you won't be allowed to speak about gender, transgender, LGBTQ+ in the curriculum, or you're not allowed to talk about evolution, that's a very serious problem. That's a very, very serious problem. And we've got to confront that. We've got to say, you know, push back, because these are the places where, as you say and Orla said, where respectful conversations have to happen. I had a really interesting conversation in the last number of weeks. We had an aviation conference in UCC. UCC is ranked in the top, as many of our institutions in Ireland, in fact, are ranked highly in sustainability. We happen to be in the top 10 for the last number of years. And our student body are really behind this agenda, as we all are, actually. So we had an aviation conference. They said, oh, no, you can't have an aviation conference. So I said, hang on a second. Let's talk this through. They want to have a protest. I said, maybe you can have a protest. But what we did instead was that the students addressed the conference, and then they had a conversation. But so we all need to learn from each other and respect that in a university there are places where we will disagree, and we must learn to disagree, and learn to disagree is a good thing, actually, and we don't fall out and we carry on and come to some conclusion or no conclusions. And I think we're still in this country, I believe we're still in that place, but maybe I'm complacent.
I heard Louise Richardson use a phrase recently that I liked, that universities should be places of robust civility, which I like.
Yeah.
So civility, but with that robust steel to it, with that robustness.
I'm a believer in robust civility. Yeah, but for example, or just go back to the trustworthy thing with that. Just thinking in terms of the scholarly world, right? It seems to me that in recent years, in particular, the science community, and perhaps also the engineering community, have become really complacent about, quotes, peer review. Mm. Peer review is actually now quite flaky. Mm-hmm. It's underfunded. Mm-hmm. But everywhere you look, when somebody wants to bust an argument, they say, well, it was a peer-reviewed paper. Right, and that's dangerous, because we're not interrogating that, There's also a problem of replication in science, for example.
But put it the other way, I mean, yes, there are problems with everything. People will say there's problems with the Leaving Cert, there's problems with peer review, but what's the alternative? That's the, it has its flaws, absolutely. What I'm a bit more concerned about peer review is that at the moment, some of the really busy top class researchers just don't peer review, actually, because it's too consuming and it's too much time involved. So I agree with the weaknesses, John, but the question is, what's the alternative? And I'm not sure we have found one. I mean, open access is one, but then how do we peer review that in an open access? I'm not distinguishing from open access publishing, which I agree with. But, you know, I think I'd like to know what you think or Orla thinks about an alternative proposition to peer review.
But I mean, the problem with open access, I mean, the philosophy behind the open access thing is that, as computer people used to say, given enough eyeballs, all bugs are shallow.
Yeah.
So if you submit a thing to a number of... but that's a kind of belief in the marketplace of ideas. If enough people have looked at something, you know, that it's baloney, actually.
I think all our experience with social media would not tell us that that is
that's
proven
exactly
to be robust or civil.
Thank you. A second question that I want to ask you about, because my aim in life is to make you uncomfortable. It's not working yet, but I'm going to stick with
somehow I think it's going to happen, John, fairly soon anyway.
It's the way in which I think across the world, if we're going to have a society that's very largely driven by certain kinds of technology, then the question that needs to be asked always is, what is it for, other than private gain, right? That question is not asked too much. And the job of disciplines in universities, among other things, is to ask that question, the humanities. Okay. And yet, almost everywhere in the world, humanities and universities are being eviscerated and marginalized almost. Now, I know that you had an interesting experience in UCC that that's not the case, but broadly speaking, I think that's happening. And that's really scary.
It is. I come to UCC in Rome because, I think Ireland is better, but we made particular steps on it. I'd like to mention those in a few moments. I think you're right, John. I think, if funding is following a certain trajectory, and particularly behind the STEM, and I'm a scientist behind the STEM subjects, then the scholars in the humanities are less valued and get less enjoy, less funding. But then if we all bring ourselves back to those horrible COVID days, what did we miss most? Music performances, poetry, dance. Meeting, the creative practice. And yet, our own son, dear to say, our own son is a musician. And there's many musicians in the room here today. Poorly paid. And all their music is streamed for half nothing. So there's a kind of a disconnect between what we value and what we pay for. We value it highly, we're not prepared to pay for it. So there's something for us to challenge about the whole area of the humanities area. And I say that, I'm an ecologist and engineer. Or scientists don't think I'm a scientist, and the humanities don't think I'm a scientist. So I'm in that interstitial space, because ecologists actually are dealing with both, because humans live in ecosystems as anything else. So I try to find that space, but I'd like to come back to what we did in UCC, because I had a moment when I became president to say, because I don't know if Orla had this experience, but when you go into this role as a scientist, everybody say, oh, we're all going one direction and the world is going to fall apart and we're not going to have a comprehensive university, which we enjoy. And I said, let's signal. And the very first step I did was I appointed 12 faculty positions in radical humanities. And we set up a radical humanities laboratory. And I know you were involved in this, John. So
actually, you ruined my summer. But anyway.
Pardon me?
I was an external assessor on many of the interview boards for this. So I spent much of my summer cursing him because I was stuck to a bloody Zoom screen.
So we had 850 applications from all over the world for these 12 faculty positions. And we got absolutely outstanding scholars. So what is radical humanities? It's precisely what you're talking about, John. It's that intersection between technology, automation, computing, the psychology, the ethics, the social impact, and putting, because the world doesn't live in silos as we construct them in universities or anywhere else, actually. It's a trans and multidisciplinary system. So a radical humanities, to me, and any humanities, are absolutely critical to our decision. And to be, I think, to be fair with Horizon and SFI and other areas, there is an acknowledgement now that we need those voices constructing a course, constructing the research and engaging in it,
Well, in UCD, it's not, the humanities are not withering, but nevertheless.
Not at all, no. No, and I think the experience in Ireland is different from what you're seeing in the UK and the US and other jurisdictions, not to deny the importance of what you're talking about, but it would be a very foolish university in Ireland that would seek to shrivel up the humanities. They are so integral to our history, our personality, our reputation. It would be very, very foolish for a university president or university leader to underplay that. So we in UCD, we're investing in all sorts of strategic positions around various areas of humanities and social sciences. PJ Matthews is here, heads up for us, the Creative Futures Academy, collaboration with other institutions, targeting the creative industries and creative practice. We've got a wonderful black box theatre that we're developing in the basement of the Newman building in UCD. So we've got loads going on. Our library, we have amazing plans going on in our library in terms of our great cultural collection. So we have loads going on in support of the humanities, and certainly I, as president, will never hold back on that. A lovely story, which is really current for us in UCD at the moment. Some of you may have seen that last night we successfully launched Ireland's first satellite. Okay. This is a project going back 6 years in UCD. Absolutely fantastic, student-focused project. That little satellite is floating above us somewhere now. Etched on the side of it is a poem written by our creative writing professor working with a group of students from Desh schools. So they together wrote this poem about the mission of the satellite, and it's etched on the side of the satellite. So it is up there now. And to me, that is what UCD is. That is what Irish higher education is about. That fusion of the best of who we are. And it shows how the STEM disciplines can inspire. That story has inspired so much creativity and imagination around our system. Just as the humanities disciplines can support our economy, can support jobs, can support our country. Again, when you look at Ireland's economic success, yes, so much of it is focused on our success in the STEM disciplines, but also on the fact that we are a country where people want to live. And that is so much to do with our cultural presence as a country. And again, that's very much what this event is all about. So for me, I think we're better than most countries in maintaining that parity of esteem, if you like, between the STEM and the humanities disciplines. And long may that continue.
And if I might remind you, am I correct in thinking that the motto of UCD is Ad Astra?
It is. It is.
To the stars.
Sorry. That's one of our two mottos. Yeah. The other one is Coram Fainia, which is about diversity, okay, inclusion, free, right, fairness, if you like.
I'm trying to assert my humanities expertise.
Yes, yes,
that,
yeah, yes. Thank you.
By the way, I should say, John did ruin my summer in one respect, but it was actually a very inspiring experience for a lot of reasons. One of them is the quality of the people who applied was astonishing. 850, of whom 300, I think, were pretty good, 100... very good, and 30 or 40 stellar. So I was sitting there, and my role in it, I was the external assessor on these things, and I had you get assigned a question, and my question was, because at the particular moment we were there, my question was, a multi-billionaire who runs one of the most powerful tech companies in the world and thinks he's the emperor, Justin, has decided to wager £10 billion and to employ 10,000 engineers on building a virtual world. And what he's gambling on is that in 10, 15 years, that the vast majority of the human population will be content to spend their lives inside this virtual world. Now, what have the humanities to say about that? Mm. It was a really interesting, it's a tough question. But one other thing that I got from that, which was the quality of the applicants was astonishing. And the first question in the interviews was, well, why did you choose UCC? And, of course, you get the usual stuff about what a fine university it is and the rest of it. But actually, in many cases, because it's in Europe. Mm-hmm. Isn't that interesting? Yeah. Anyway, and that goes back to the thing about Ireland being unique and different. I mean, there's one sense in which it is, and that is in relation to the way in which this country has tried to vitalise deliberative democracy. Mm. Mm. That's really important. There's only one other country in the world, as far as I know, that's doing that.
Yeah.
And it's very, very refreshing and useful. Is that a way of which you know.
It's the Citizens' Assembly you're thinking of.
And you use that.
We use it, so John's referring to the Citizens' Assembly, and where you can measure, as we all know, measure the temperature of people. And you know, Catherine Day used to chair our board. She said what she, because she chaired one of the Citizens' Assembly, and she said what she found remarkable is how, despite all the complexity that specialists might give, she said, the people that are voting are able to get to this core issue very rapidly. And actually, the proportion of them represented was exactly the same in the elections as they found when from the Citizens' Assembly. So we have some difficult decisions to take with our student body, and we decided to set up a student Citizens' Assembly based exactly on the same model to help us to understand some of the issues, but also to hear those voices and help them to find us, to get solutions. And it's a fantastic, developed by a colleague from UCD.
David Farrell in UCD, who's the father, if you like, of the Citizens' Assembly, which has been rolled out, you know, very successfully in Ireland and elsewhere in the world. But that's a great example, you know, on our topic here of universities and the role that we play in supporting democracy and generating trust. That's a brilliant example of how a single academic can bring about real change through his expertise and his application.
Before you leave the humanities, though, the scientists might say it's a good idea to clone a dinosaur, but the humanities scholars might think differently.
They might. Actually, accidentally, we did it. He's called Elon Musk. Anyway, okay.
That wasn't the fellow you were talking about in the question earlier, was it?
Right. Another issue where, I mean, the reason we're talking about this in a way is because I'm concerned that our democracies are foolishly complacent about their stability and their prospects of continuity, and if we have a trustworthy, we hope, trustworthy institution like universities in it, they might have a more special responsibility than they realise. But I wanted to turn to something else as well, which is the feeling that universities are apolitical. And of course, in one respect, they are. But in a strange way, unwittingly, they have become very, very politically important in a way that nobody ever dreamed. For example, in the UK and the US in particular, I don't know what it's like in Europe, but in continental Europe, but in the UK, I think it's true that not a single university town in the UK voted for Brexit. Not a single one. Okay, and when you look at voting patterns in the United Kingdom now, the real dividing line is increasingly whether you went to university or not. Okay, now this is not because universities set out to do that, but it has happened. And what it means, in a sense, is that as institutions they have real responsibilities. In the US, it's even more chronic, because whether or not you have a degree, a third level degree, in the US, is basically a determinant, to a large extent, of your life chances. Okay, and if that's the case, then it means that when you're educating people, there's something about education for citizenry or something that's needed and is not present. Is that right?
I think this is a really, really interesting question. In the US, they often call it the diploma divide. Again, as you say, John, the fact that higher education status is the greater predictor of how you will vote than anything else, along with how much money you'll make, your health over the course of your life, how long you'll live, and not even how you'll vote, but even your understanding of how you react to information and expertise, and whether you accept expertise or whether you are threatened by expertise, you know, your approach to diversity, you know, all of the diversity of thought, diversity of the people around you. So higher education status has a huge impact on this. Now, you know, there's a danger to this. Before we get into the danger, let's maybe talk about some of the positives of it. It does suggest to an extent that what we're doing in higher education is what we should be doing. We are advancing life opportunity for those who undertake higher education. You know, we are exposing people to diversity of thought. So there is a positive hidden in this, but there's a much broader concern for all of us and for democracy when you have this enormous polarisation of societies into two groups that are increasingly suspicious and disdainful of one another. That is not good for any of us. So we in higher education cannot live in a bubble where we and our people are doing fine, thank you very much, and there's a lot of other people outside the fold. So that is A, unethical, and B, not very smart from a survival point of view. So I think it absolutely behoves us to think about this question and how we address it. One of the ways is through access, making sure that everybody has the opportunity to access higher education based on merit, et cetera, and based on those who need it and want it, but to be really open to underrepresented groups. Another one is true engagement with all communities. And this is not universities as some latter-day Lady Bountiful going out and sharing our great wisdom. It is about listening. It is about engaging. It is about taking on board all concerns, bringing them into our fusion, if you like, of ideas, as we spoke about earlier, and making sure that what comes out is relevant to all our stakeholders.
John, can I add to that? I think what Orla said is a few other strands I'd like to pick up. I think universities are very complex areas. You know, there are layers from high-performance researchers, and there's a fantastic project happening in this very peninsula, led by the Dingle Hub here, and looking at energy systems within the entire Dingle Peninsula. But let me go to the other end. And I'll just tell, this is a true story. I don't often tell it. So some of you might know the quadrangle.
You do often tell true stories.
Well, I often tell not this particular true story. Okay. So some of you might know the quadrangle, and you see there's some beautiful Ohm stones there. So one morning I was walking out, 9:30 in the morning, I still remember it, some years ago, and I was walking by, and this person brushed against me. And they said, "It's unusual to see somebody wearing a suit around here." Now, this is an open campus, and I had no idea what was going to happen next, genuinely. The next question, where can I learn to read?
Wow.
And I put my arm around the person and said, "Come on, let's do that." And we pointed them and supported them. And I'm sure it's no different in UCD and all our institutions. So that gave me, I made two observations from that. I said, wow, an incredibly courageous person coming in through the foreboding walls of a university that we all have, and all the kind of so-called wise people in there. So we're not as impenetrable as sometimes people think we are. So a huge fair play to that person. I also think it said something about us.
Yeah.
There's somebody the confidence to come into our institution, and there's somebody in a suit in some sort of odd place would actually point them in some direction. So I think the layers that we see in our organisations, from high-performance researchers right through to the access that Orla speaks of. I had the privilege of graduating 22 traveller women very recently. We should have 42 of them. We should have 102 of them. But their message to me was that they were afraid to come into the campus on their own. They came as groups. So we all have a lot of work to do, collectively as institutions. But I suppose the message I'm trying to get across is, we talk about universities, they are very diverse places in themselves and have layers and layers and layers of complexity with one mission: to try and make education available for people to live long and fruitful lives, really. That's what we're seeking to do.
You just reminded me of something from my own history, because I remember the day I walked up to enrol. In the old days, when I was an undergraduate, you walked up and enrolled.
Yeah.
Right? And I walked up, I remember walking up the driveway and going through the arch. And my feeling was that I had died and gone to heaven without the expense. Basically, I couldn't believe it. I'm the first member of my family who went to university. You are the first member of your family who went to university?
Yeah. Yeah.
You are?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So from that point of view, it was really quite a radical, magical kind of transformation.
Yeah.
And for many people, they thought they wouldn't. It's not for us. It's not for me, whatever. But, for example, in Cambridge, you can, which is, it has a very well-known university. It's very wealthy. It's a bubble of prosperity because of the tech industry and so on. But you can walk from my college for 30 minutes across Cambridge, and life expectancy goes down by 10 years.
Wow. Right? But if I said to you that 25% of our students, of our 25,000 students coming to UCC, are from non-traditional backgrounds, 25%. But actually, that's great coming in. But do they succeed when they come in? The answer is yes. All the higher education systems, including UCD and ourselves and others, have a very high retention. We're up at 94%. That means 94 of every 100 that start finish. That's a huge credit to all our staff and all the people who are giving all the support. There's a lot of success stories. We're not going to be complacent, but there are a lot of success stories there, in spite of all the challenges that we all, including myself, complain about.
Yeah.
You know?
And something we're not all that good about is communicating these stories.
Yeah.
I think that when you talk about trust in universities, communication is absolutely integral to that. You know, getting messages out there, telling people what we do, listening to people. I think that we really need to get better at that.
Following on from that, when Tony Blair came into power in 1997, one of the Labour manifesto pledges was that they would increase the proportion of the age cohort leaving school to going to university to 50%. And I think they got there. But one of the measurable and observable consequences of that was that in the first few years, there were lots of kids in British universities who didn't know why they were there, really. Mm. That might not have been true here because of our cultural differences, but it was really quite striking. I'm wondering whether sometimes is the right thing to say to a young person who's saying to you, what should I be doing? The automatic response at the moment, you should go to university. Well, is that the best advice sometimes you can give to a kid?
I don't think it should be the only answer, not by any stretch of the imagination. There's a lot of focus in this country at the moment on apprenticeships, and I think we really need to strengthen all these pathways for those coming out of school. So a university education, and we're even higher than the 50%, we're over 60% in Ireland, and I would absolutely argue that that is a good thing. I think it's been a great thing for our society in every respect. I'm part, as you say, John, you know, I was the first in my family to attend university. I was part of that generation in Ireland that graduated in the 1980s, came out as a really well-educated cohort of engineers and found no jobs in the country for us, left en masse, and then gained experience abroad, in many cases came back, generated the activity that fueled Ireland's economic, cultural, societal transformation. And for all the problems that we have in this country at this time, just think how much worse they would be were it not for the wealth and prosperity that has ensued from that. So I'm a real believer in the power of university education to transform lives, as it did mine, and to transform societies and countries. So it's not the only path, but I think it will continue to be a really, really important path and a differentiator for Ireland. And the fact that we continue to have this allegiance to a strong university system, robust against many of the challenges we've been discussing here, I think that is a real strength for Ireland. We have our problems. The underfunding that John started off on is definitely one of them, but we've a lot to celebrate.
That, it's culturally very different in that sense from the UK. So one of the things I noticed in the UK from the very beginning when I went to live there is that engineering is not a kind of an elite. It's not perceived as anything interesting to do. It's something that, and one of the problems I had, and I've been writing for newspapers forever, as well as being an academic. And I, what the thing I realized very early on is that you must never, ever, ever reveal to anybody in a newspaper in Britain that you understand how this crap works. Because if you did, then you immediately got typecast. Bottle specs, pens in your top pocket, some really boring kind of lower class kind of guy. And that's, that among other things, the consequences of that is that Britain has no plumbers.
Yeah.
And it used to have a lot of good plumbers. They came from Poland. And now they're not there.
And more significantly, look at their industrial base.
Yes, same thing. But
the engineers are talking again, this year.
Yeah.
But there's not. Some of my best friends are engineers. No, but it's true. It was,
yeah.
And of course, the result is different. This is a country which, partly because of our history, which was that education was often the only visible way of escaping or getting better or whatever. And I remember two of my aunts, for example. My father's family are peasant farmers in Connemara. Two of my aunts, they got a third level education. Why? Because they decided the only way to do it is be a teacher. And you got free education.
Yeah.
But
John, coming back to your enrolling, when you were enrolling, I was talking to somebody last week who was an alumnus of UCC, and they said when they arrived to register,
yeah,
they looked at the length of the queues. Didn't matter what the subject was.
Yeah.
And they went to the shortest
one. I've heard those stories as well. Yeah.
And this guy said, I was going to do engineering, but he ended up doing dentistry.
Yeah.
Well, two things.
No difference in my mind, but anyway. But I suppose what it points to is we can put all these structures and things in place, including the HPAT and all those kinds of things, actually. But fundamentally, if you get a highly motivated young person who wants to do something special, and they're not young, special, and they motivate and work hard, they'll succeed. And we give them the architecture to scaffold them to grow and do it, you know.
Yeah. I became an engineer, but I grew up in Tralee, down the road. And the most interesting person in Tralee, I discovered, was an engineer. And I thought, I want to be like that. Alas, he was more interesting than me, but there you go. Now, going back, but this thing about the cultural belief in education, that's I think, quite very strong here, and it's not in the same way in other societies. There's an interesting kind of problem there, because everybody in this room, I guess, everybody you talk to in Ireland believes that, you know, it's really important, education, a good education is really important, and so on and so forth. Every politician you talk to in the Dáil or in the Horseshoe Bar in the Shelburne is going to tell you, oh, yes, of course, it's really, really important, the rest of it. But God damn it, none of these bloody people actually will fund it.
Yeah.
So
that's
why is that?
It's extraordinary.
And it's not that they can't afford it. This country can't afford it. It has money coming out of its ears from the tech companies.
Yeah.
Right? So why aren't they funding it?
And there's a quote that I like from Joe Biden. It says, don't tell me what you value. Show me your budget and I'll tell you what you value.
Yeah.
And every politician, every civil servant I speak to, they all get the importance of higher education. Like, they really do get it. They get the importance of research. It's when it comes to funding priorities, when we have to fit into an interleaving with health and homelessness and all the other aspects that they have to fund, that's where we somehow slip down the list. So it's a question of voicing, and to an extent, we're our own worst enemies, because we have these beautiful, shiny buildings on our campuses, and when politicians come through, we take them into our shiny buildings, we tell them how wonderful our research is. Industry snap up our graduates and can't get enough of them, say how brilliant they are. So what politicians say, so what's the problem? You know, you're doing great, well done, keep it up.
And I just I think Orla is right there, and what we've tried to do in our case is to measure the economic impact of the institution and culture. So we've just done an analysis, we're doing a reanalysis for UCC. The economic impact of University College Cork in the region is €1 billion a year, three million a day. And Mark Redmond is down in the front row here. And when we talk to all the industries that are in the Cork area, you say, would you be in Cork if University College Cork was not there? And the answer is no. So we need Mark and the champions of industry to support us from government to say, actually, we need this talent in order for us to have a good economy and a cultural economy, not just enterprise, but actually a good, deep culture, which universities bring, which we haven't really talked about, the extent to which universities enrich our culture.
But the problem is that the organisers of Ireland's Edge, miserable that they are, decided that we would decided that we would just have this short period to talk, and not only that, but it's been 42 seconds of coming to an end. So can I just say, first of all, my objective in embarrassing these two people hasn't worked, and say thank them.
Thank you
for coming.
Well,
and
thank you.
Thank you so much to Orla Feely and John O'Halloran for joining John Nocton in Dingle. On our next episode, the generational divide over climate change. To make sure you don't miss that or any of our future episodes, subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts. This has been a Southwind Blows production, and I'm Christopher Kassan. Thank you for joining us. I look forward to your company next time on Ireland's Edge.